moments later. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
It's wonderful to be here, isn't it? Isn't it nice to be cooler than it was earlier as well? It's a pleasure to have you here. This is our first program for the fall, and it's just thrilling to have you all here. My name is Denise Lucy, and I'm the professor and executive director of the Institute for Leadership Studies, and I've greeted many of you before, and it's a pleasure to have you here tonight. Thank you. So aren't we all thrilled to have Connie Chung in the hall? Her new book is called Connie, A Memoir. It's along with behind-the-scenes stories about her life and her career, and we can't wait to hear what she has to say. And our Leadership Studies program here, the lecture series at Dominican University, is a program for our Institute for Leadership Studies, and we are thrilled to say that it is a leadership development center that supports our students who are seeking degrees, as well as your firms and your organizations, your government leaders that want to become better leaders and team members. So please send them our way, will you please? We'd love to have you. The purpose of the lecture series is to engage students, the campus, and the entire community in socially relevant conversations that are thought-provoking. So in fall of 2024 marks our 20th anniversary of the Leadership Lecture Series. Can I hear you say yay? Yay! And we've presented over 180 amazing, thought-provoking people and change leaders who have come to this campus because of the friendship, partnership, and camaraderie with Elaine and Bill Petrocelli. And I cannot thank them enough for bringing their remarkable, talented team to join ours. It's really been, would you please thank them with me? Thank you. Thank you so much, Elaine and Bill and Karen and the whole team. So leadership cuts across our curriculum. We seek to have leadership is not just in business, it's across the curriculum. And we define it as affecting positive and ethical change. So for that 180 authors that Book Passages helped us bring, we've opened your hearts and we've opened your minds. From politics to music to novels to cooking. Don't you think cooking's important? I don't cook, but I know you might. But we have the most remarkable people who've helped us change our lives through that medium. So we've also had over 100,000 guests in this hall as a consequence of this partnership. And 1 million YouTube channels at the Dominican YouTube channel. That's 85% of all Dominican YouTube business, the Leadership Lecture Series. Thank you so much for all of you coming. We're thrilled to have you, and please come again. Yes, thank you, Carolyn. Let's have a clap. There you go. Okay, so let us do the most important thing, of course, is to bring Connie out to the stage. But before we do, remember that Elaine and Bill, they've had their bookstore for 45 years, and it's become a community center, I always call it. And whenever, if ever you want a great cup of coffee and a wonderful conversation with each other and great thinkers, please go to Elaine and Bill's bookstores, both here in Marin and in San Francisco. So thank you to Bill and Elaine Petrocelli for their support to our university. Thank you. I also want to mention, did you see our student colleagues that greeted you tonight? We call them the Leadership Host Ambassadors. They are remarkable, aren't they? Courteous, smart as ever, and very, I hope they felt welcomed by you. You felt welcomed by them. So thank you. Thank you, Leadership Host Ambassadors, for coming this evening and for always. Okay, so tonight we have a silver sponsor, and that Women Leadership and Philanthropy Council. How many have been here before? Quite a few. And how many have not been here before? Only a couple dozen. Fantastic. So you have not met Women Leadership and Philanthropy Council before. And I wonder if our WLPC members would raise your hands, please. Yes! It's the best women's leadership group in the world. I'm happy to be a member. And thank you so much for your sponsorship for our lecture series. The council is a giving circle that inspires women to lead, collaborate, and to contribute. And we do that together, and we really appreciate your partnership. Our diamond sponsor this fall and spring is Christine Christensen of Engel & Völkers. Yes, that's it. And she will introduce our esteemed speaker tonight. For 20 years, Christine has represented Marin's luxury real estate market. She's a founding member of Dominican's Women Leadership and Philanthropy Council. She's an alumna of Dominican University of California in our MBA International Business Program. And she is just a remarkable friend, and just can't thank her enough for bringing all of you together in beautiful homes and coming here tonight to introduce our guest and to provide her support and her sponsorship. Could we please thank Christine Christensen for that? So I'd like to bring Christine out so she will introduce our guest, Connie Chung. Christine? She's talking too. Christine? I guess you can't hear backstage. Christine Christensen.
Good evening. It is my sincere honor to introduce tonight's speaker. Well, yep. All right. I'm going to try that again. Good evening. It's my thank you. It is my sincere honor to introduce tonight's speaker, a trailblazing journalist for NBC, CBS, ABC, Connie Chung shattered glass ceilings, paving the way for many women and Asians alike. In 1969, at age 23, the once shy daughter of Chinese parents took her first job at a local TV station in her hometown of Washington, D.C. Soon thereafter, Connie Chung joined CBS as a national correspondent for the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. Based in D.C., she covered Capitol Hill, the White House, the Pentagon, State Department, and politics in general. Ms. Chung was tenacious in her pursuit of stories, battling rival reporters for scoops that ranged from the first interview with Magic Johnson after his HIV diagnosis to covering the Watergate scandal that led to President Nixon's resignation. She quickly became a household name. Connie Chung made broadcast television history as the first woman to co-anchor the CBS Evening News and the first Asian to anchor any news program in the country. In Connie, a memoir, Connie Chung pulls no punches as she shares a behind-the-scenes tour of her life and career, from showdowns with powerful men in and out of the newsroom, where overt sexism was a way of life, to the stories behind her career-defining reporting. Please join me in welcoming an American broadcasting icon to our stage, Connie Chung.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your coming out tonight to Dominican. And I was able to learn a little bit about the university, and I discovered that it was actually formed in 1850, is that correct? I hope my research is accurate. And that it was the first Catholic college to graduate a woman in to get a BA degree. And then the other is that I learned that your motto is truth is a flaming torch. And you know, that's very close to my heart, because I believe that journalism is all about truth. And we live our lives really concentrating on ferreting out the truth and finding the truth. I embarked on this career, but my husband, you know, Maury Povich, who's been determining the paternity of every child in America, I can assure you he has a wider vocabulary than you are the father and you are not the father. In fact, he's a voracious reader, and he's a political buff and a history buff, and I've always marveled at how much people don't know about him. He used to do a talk show that interviewed authors, you know, like Gore Vidal and Tom Wolfe and Maya Angelou. And this is a very, you know, obviously, there's some students out there, yes? How many students are here? Can you raise your hand? Yeah, a few. Oh, there you go. Thank you. Is Morgan, are you there? Okay, because Morgan is audio video, right? With you. Are you majoring in this audio video work? Finance major? Oh, you go, girl. That's way too cool. But you've got techie abilities, right? Very good. So then, anyway, Maury, it was Maury who suggested that I write a memoir. And I was, I said, I don't know. And he said, no, you have a good story to tell. So I thought, okay, I'll give it a go. But it was quite a long time ago. It was nearly a decade ago. And I decided that I needed some guidance. And so I asked him, what was your favorite memoir that you read? And he said, Personal History by Katharine Graham. It was a woman named Katharine Graham who was the lone woman publisher of the Washington Post for many years. And she went through a lot of ups and downs during the tumultuous years of the Pentagon Papers and the Watergate. So, but what I found was that she was never woe is me. She was never crying in her soup. And despite all the hurdles that she faced, I was rooting for her. I found that the way she wrote it, I was rooting for her all the way until the end. That's the kind of memoir that I wanted to create. So if I may, I'll tell you a little bit about my background, because I'm delighted to know that this is a very diverse university, and that one of your claims to fame is just how diverse you are. My parents were born in China in 1909 and 1911, and to a most traditional family, my mother's feet were bound, like, tiny little 4 to 5 inches, it was the tradition. It was as inexplicable as the tiny waists that Victorian women were forced to have. Those tiny little waists. She didn't like it, of course, because it hurt. And my mother's father said, it's okay, if she doesn't want her feet down, I'll take care of her. Then their marriage was, they were engaged at ages 12 and 14, and then their marriage was arranged for them to be married at 17 and 19. It was a horrible, actually, situation. Oh, was that? Did that drop? Oh, man. You know, one time I was doing the news and a light burst, and I, you know, it sounded really scary, but I just looked up, saw that it burst, and I just moved on and said, don't worry, it's just a light that burst. So you gotta be ready for anything. That was kind of scary. Well, anyway, so they had this arranged marriage, and they had 9 children in China. 5 of them died as infants. 3 of those 5 who died as infants were boys. That did not sit well with the grandparents or my parents. So when I was born, the 10th, in the United States, they came in 1945, and I was born in 1946. I'll do the math for you. I'm 78. You know, you're going, let's see, 46. Ah, oh, you gotta love America. You get applause for being old. There we were. I was born, and I was yet another girl. Not great news for my parents, because certainly they still wanted the boy, but whatever. I grew up with five sisters who were bossy as heck, and I couldn't get a word in edgewise, and one of my elementary school teachers said, wrote in my report card, I speak too softly. So I changed that, didn't I? So when I went to school, I was very shy and all of that. I eventually got into the news business, and I found a letter from my father that said that he thought that perhaps I could tell the story of how your parents, as he put it, came from China and how they escaped the Sino-Japanese War, which was going on and preceded the communist takeover of China. And he said, maybe you can carry on the name Chung, essentially saying, maybe you can be the son that we never had. And I think I took that mission, since I believed in filial piety, I think I took that mission seriously. So when I went into the news business, I found that I was surrounded by men. And I have a photograph of that I'd love. Well, Morgan, wait one second. I'm sorry. Sorry, that was a false start. I discovered that I was among men, because when I started in 1969, there were hardly any women, just a smattering of women, and it was actually thanks to the civil rights law that was passed in 1964 that women began to be hired, because in the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission was formed because of the 1964 law. And my sister-in-law, her name is Lynn Povich, Maury's sister, was a Newsweek reporter at the time, a Newsweek researcher. Women at Newsweek were only hired as researchers. They could not advance to reporter or writer or editor, anything of the sort. So these women, including my sister-in-law, met in the ladies' room, the only where they only place they could get privacy to meet and come up with the idea of filing a class action lawsuit against Newsweek, demanding that they be moved into higher level jobs. They won, and all corporations across America were threatened with the women's movement and the black movement. That caused my eventual employer, Bill Small, at the Washington Bureau of CBS, to hire women. I was among that small wave of four women who were hired. But the way I got the job was I was working for a local station. I was doing a story on unsanitary conditions at restaurants in Washington, D.C. I barged into a restaurant just the way Mike Wallace would, you know, like demanding to see the owner. He watched me as I, you know, was so bold and brave, just this little 25-year-old woman, and he gave me his card and said, call me. And so I figured, well, let's see, he was just about finished lunch. He'll be back at the office shortly. I called him 20 minutes later and I got the job. So there we were, having entered the news business in what I consider, and I saw it, CBS News, which was the Tiffany Network. It was the creme de la creme. It was the place to be, because Walter Cronkite was doing the news. You know, good evening, this is Walter Cronkite. And I, my parents and I, and my four older sisters, we all sat down to watch Uncle Walter. And he was the quintessential anchor man. And I wanted to be Walter Cronkite. I thought that was a dream that would never occur. But there I was working in the Washington Bureau with the best bureau in the country, and reporting news for Walter Cronkite. So there I was. It was a newsroom full of men. There was one woman who did radio reports, and there was one black reporter. Other than that, it was all men. White men. Not that there's anything wrong with being white. I mean, I'm married to one, right? and so I found that the reporters who were competing with me were all men, and everyone I covered on Capitol Hill were men. They were on Capitol Hill, the White House, the Pentagon, the State Department. They were all men. And I have a photograph now, Morgan. Would you put up this photograph? If you put up this photograph, you'll see I was covering, you got it, Morgan? It's okay. Anyway, I was covering the House Judiciary Committee hearings into the impeachment of Richard Nixon. It was 1974. The picture was taken by Dev O'Neill, the Capitol Hill photographer. He gave it to me. And since it's public domain, because it's part of the Capitol Hill largesse of photographs, I was able to use it for my book and to show you once Morgan finds it. She's scrolling through the computer, and now George is coming to help. George, I don't think you can do it. I think Morgan will do it, I swear. But anyway, you'll see that I'm standing there looking bushed, like I've had it. It was put on social media by the wife of a guy who works at CBS, and I call the photograph the Sea of Men. And it became, whoa! There you go. And it went viral because, there you go. Thank you. George, did you really do it or you really didn't? Morgan did. I look like I've had it, right? And it went viral as a hashtag mood, which in social media parlance means I have so been there, because a lot of people went on and said, I know what she's thinking, I've been there. When I go into the office, that's what I see, a sea of men. There's a tiny little lady to the right, on the right side, and her husband owned some newspapers, and she was a bit of a gadfly. I never saw anything that she wrote, but she was always hanging around the edges. The man on the left sitting at the dais, because Dev O'Neill is up on the dais, is Bill Cohen, congressman. He became Secretary of Defense, and he became a senator from Maine. And then this is Congressman Larry Hogan with his kind of wide tushy there. But anyway, that just said it all to me, that, you know, he's just there. It was a sea of men. I one of the greatest moments was, wait a minute, I want to make sure that I get provide enough time for Q&A. Let's see. Was it Elaine? Elaine, tell me how long what time you want to go to Q&A? Oh, Elaine, I know you're back there. Oh, well, she'll tell me. Oh, hi, Elaine. About 7:40? Okay, thank you. This sounds good. I went through my career facing a good amount of sexism and racism, and I decided that to counter it, I was pretty young, I was in my mid-20s, I decided I'm going to become a guy just like them, because as I looked around, all I saw were these men. So I decided to take pages from their playbook and take on their characteristics. I would walk into a room with bravado. I would try and own the room the way they did. I had confidence, I had moxie, I was bold and I was brave. I looked like a lotus blossom, but I talk like a sailor. I don't recommend it, but I had a potty mouth. And it was not becoming, but it was my way of countering them. And they really didn't know what to do about it because, you know, when I would come back with something that was sassy and saucy, and they would really be flummoxed. They didn't know how to come back at me. So I had so convinced myself that I was just another white guy that when I went past a mirror, I'd go, whoa, I saw a Chinese woman staring back at me. So here I was, this little thing that no one knew what to do with, but I was tough and I covered a lot of stories that I covered the McGovern campaign in 1972 and Watergate. When I covered Watergate, there was Nixon was staying underground. He refused to come out and answer any questions. So he was at the White House. I was keeping the seat warm for Dan Rather, and I happened to come back through the Northwest Gate, and I was, as I was going up that driveway, and I would have turned left to go to the press room, there he was. I was shocked, and I rushed toward him. The Secret Service, I was afraid, would stop me, but they didn't. They let me amble up to him, and I tried to ask him questions because I had covered the Senate Watergate Committee hearings, and I knew what to ask. It's just that I was afraid to take out my notepad and pen because I was afraid he would walk away. So I'm peppering him with questions, and he looks at me and he says, "How much money do you make?" And I said, "Excuse me?" And he says, "How much money do you make?" And I said, $27,000 a year. But if I do a story for Walter Cronkite, I can get another $35. And if I could do a radio spot, I can get another $25. And I can get my salary up to $29,000 a year. I was very proud. And he says to me, "Just remember one thing. You have to make more money." And I thought, weird. And so then I was so flummoxed that when I was walking towards the press office, Helen Thomas, who is the dean of the press corps and worked at United Press International, she said, What'd he say? And I said, "I don't know, Helen." I had completely, my big scoop was down the drain. I didn't know what he said. 22 years later, I ended up sitting in the half of Walter Cronkite's chair. I became the first woman to anchor the CBS Evening News and sitting next to a man who didn't want to have anything to do with me. It was very much like when Barbara Walters was made the co-anchor with Harry Reasoner at ABC. I had a lot in common with Barbara Walters. Do you remember Barbara? Yeah. She became the breadwinner in her family because her father's nightclubs had tanked. And she was supporting her mother and her father and her disabled sister. I too supported my parents from the time I was about 25, 26 until the day they died. My father had retired, and he had actually worked 7 days a week. He was in China. He was a spook, a spy. He worked in intelligence for Chiang Kai-shek and got the family out through his ingenuity, really. And when he got to the United States, he worked two jobs. But what he found was that if you add up numbers on an abacus, it comes out the same as if you're using an adding machine. So he became an accountant and a financial manager. And when he retired because he had a minor heart attack, I became the breadwinner and had to make money to support them. Barbara and I both needed our jobs because we were the breadwinners in our family. So we actually took on the roles of being the men in our family. We had that in common. We also had in common that we co-anchored the news with a man who didn't want to have anything to do with us. And we were both dumped after 2 years. Also, I married a nice Jewish boy, and she married three nice Jewish boys. And I forgot to get married then. I forgot to get married forgot to have a baby. So she adopted a baby, and I adopted a baby. We both faced sexism, and then she faced ageism, and I faced racism. So I felt very close to Barbara in terms of our careers. I did end up at ABC News, and I felt that whatever Barbara wanted, she should have. And if I was competing with her for something, I always backed down if she wanted something, because I felt she earned her divadom, and she created her own niche, and she paved the way for all of us. We were covering at ABC News. We were assigned to cover the millennium. So when the year 2000 came along, we would all be put in different cities to welcome in the millennium. I was assigned to go to Paris. So yeah, woo! So Maury and I were all excited. I was going to bring him along, and he has two daughters from his earlier marriage. Two of them already they were married and had children, and then we were bringing our little son. So we were all excited, and then a vice president came up to me and said, Barbara wants to go to Paris. And I said, where am I going? And he said, Las Vegas. But I thought, okay. You know, they have a little Eiffel Tower in Las Vegas. So I had a lot of trials and tribulations during my, and I spell it all out. And Elaine says, of book passages, she says, she's glad that I told it all. But it was hard, because I wrote my first draft, and the editor said to me, you're just giving me the facts. And I said, but that's what I do. That's what I've been doing for years. And she said, no, you have to tell how you feel. And I thought, I can't do that. You know, that's not what I do. But I tried to do that. I tried to you know, just tell what happened, but I didn't want to do it in a woe is me way. So I didn't want to, because to me, there's no crying in baseball, there's no crying in news, there's no crying when you write your memoir. But I was wondering, how am I going to end this memoir? Because I didn't really have an ending. And then all of a sudden, one day, a woman cold emailed me. Her name was Connie Wong. And she said that she was named after me. And I thought, really? That's extraordinary. So I called her on the phone, and we talked. She said when she came to the United States from communist China with her parents, they settled in the Midwest. She was only 3 years old, and her parents said, we need to give you an American name. What name would you like? At three, she only knew what she saw on television. So she said, Connie or Elmo? And I'm so grateful that they chose Connie instead of the Muppet. So she goes to UC Berkeley. She's very smart. And half the students at Berkeley are Asians. And she's in the cafeteria on her first day, and somebody says, hi, Connie. And half the room turns around. So she said, this is weird. She goes to her dorm and she tries to get an email address at school. And she finds all these Connies. She said, there's something going on here. She began to become a journalist and she was working for Refinery 29 when she discovered this Connie phenomenon, that there were many women named Connie in the 70s and 80s. They were born in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, coincidentally, when I was doing the news. She wrote a great story. She went to the New York Times opinion section and said, I've got this story. And they said, go for it. If you Google it, it's called Generation Connie. Written by Connie Wong, and it's the most glorious story. A lot of people told me that they read it, they saw it, and it just touched their hearts. It certainly touched mine. The photographer, the photo editor for the New York Times opinion section said she wanted to find a photographer named Connie and bring us all together in the New York Times studio to take a photograph, and she would put me in the middle among three tiers of Connies. She found a photographer whose name was Connie Chung Aramaki, and she flew in from the West Coast. I decided to memorialize it because I knew this was going to be a moment for me in my storytelling of my book, and I had a cameraman shoot it, and Morgan, do you have the tape? Okay. There you go. Hit play. Yeah, she did.
Aramaki.
Okay.
Yeah, but my real name's Chung, actually.
Get out.
I've never seen any Connie Chung Aramaki, so I'd really be like you.
Oh, what? Yeah. You're Connie
Wang.
Wang. And you pronounce it Wang?
Yeah, I actually named myself after you.
You did?
Oh, not my parents. I did.
You mean just in your crib?
You so much.
No, I how did you do that?
Because you're iconic person.
Oh my God.
And Odenmeyer, female.
Oh my God. I know, me too. Really?
Yeah.
How old were you when you named
After
you
after college? I wanted to have some American name, and I didn't want to have Esther, Sarah. Yeah, I admire her so much.
Oh my God. No, I'm gonna ruin my makeup.
Okay, quick, everybody.
Oh,
last.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Thank you.
Oh my God.
Nice to meet you.
This is amazing. This is amazing.
It is. Thank you.
Oh my God.
It's confusing why your name, Connie. You know, when I at least when I was born, you know. But I realize what it means is, you know, your parents want you to work hard and like be brave and take chances. Yeah.
I did do that.
Yeah. So thank you.
Oh. Yeah. Thank you. Oh. It's too much. It's just too much.
Hi, Jackie.
How are you? Who needs what?
Oh my gosh.
Oh my God. It really was something else. Oh my God. Oh my gosh, you're tearing up. Oh my gosh. Oh, thank you. I was incredibly moved. And I, you know what, when going on this book tour, Connie Wong came and brought her parents, and I met her. It was wonderful. And I met 4 new Connies. It was crazy. I couldn't believe it. They came, and I met them, and then I met Connie Chung Aramaki and her parents, too. And it was just unbelievable. I asked Connie Wong how many Connie she thinks are out there, because she did so much research on it. She thinks there are thousands. And I can't imagine. It's, my husband used to say, you're the Jackie Robinson of news. And I'd go, nah. And I'm beginning to believe that maybe he was right. He was always there for me. When I was, when I'd come home, he'd look at me I'd be like, which I call a resting bitch face. maybe the school isn't Catholic anymore, is it? I don't think so. I would come home really upset, and but never crying, not a crybaby. I only cry at things that touch my heart, or commercials, you know, or sad movies. And so here I would come home, and he'd say, "Do I need to remove all the sharp objects from the kitchen?" I say, yeah. But he was always there for me. He had a mantra. Maury's wisdom was, don't take your critics seriously. Don't take that guy who said that to you seriously. Don't take yourself seriously. Take your work seriously. And that's what he did. And I believe that he very much carried me through. He was my foundation, my support beam, my consigliere. He was there for me the whole time, talking me off the ledge as the sharks were circling under me. I always say, in the book, I said, everybody needs a mentor or a Maury. And I do believe that. He's been a great husband. And I'm very fortunate that when I was fired from CBS, 2 days later, we learned that our adoption that we had been working hard for 2 years was coming through. So CBS had offered me this wonderful job, I went, goodbye, because our son was in my arms, about 2 weeks later, and he was less than a day old. So now I feel very fortunate that I have a wonderful husband and a wonderful son, and I had a great career. I just didn't do it all at the same time. I marvel at women today who can do both. But I think it might be because the young men of today are pitching in much more than my era. And I thank my lucky stars that I had a long career, and then I had a long period to be a mom. And I've always had my husband at my side. He's 85. Woo! And he's just still rocking. So I thank you. And now I think Elaine is going to come up, and she has taken questions from me.
That was amazing. Thank you, Connie, for just giving so much of yourself, not only tonight, but in this book. Wait till you read all this stuff. And speaking of Connie's, now there is a second.
Can you hear Elaine? Yeah, you can?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, good.
Even though
it's
I'm
more important that
hear.
She hear me.
Okay.
But now there's a new generation of Connie's. Young mothers come into the bookstore with their strollers, and there's a Connie there, and they're Asian moms. And so they're naming them after their friend, after their mom. I don't know.
Really?
But you've got a whole new branch of Connies.
Yeah.
They're about this tall. So it goes on, and I'm so glad it does. So other than your husband, who I admire so much, were there any other men in TV news who were treating you like an equal, or were they all like that?
Were they all pigs? there were a few, yeah. There were, but I had this problem of being dutiful. I was a double dose of dutiful by being a woman and Chinese. So there were any man who was, they were all men in management, and any man who was above me was, I had this feeling that I had to abide by what they wanted. And there were many times when I should have said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to go cover that story. But I have a lot of shoulda, woulda, couldas in that respect. I should have said no. But it was really hard to in that era, I think. lots of times I was bold enough to step on the men's toes, and they didn't like it, but I did it. And you know what it was like, Elaine. I mean, you're not, and you're, she's a toughie. We were talking in the ladies' room. She's, you know, she knows the ropes. And when you,
yep.
And we just had to acquiesce from time to time. I never wanted to be called the B word. I never wanted to be called a diva. So there were many times when I went ahead and did what they wanted me to do, and I regret it.
Yeah. I watch my daughters, and they don't do that. They don't do what I did. They don't feel they have to please everybody all the time, which... Mm. But here's a question that someone asked that just fits right in. Growing up, were you a role model? Did you have a role model? Because you were a role model for me. And I would love to know, this person asked, was there anyone to be a role model for this
for
person?
Me.
No, for okay. You, because you were a role model for the person who asked this question.
Oh my goodness. Well, not really. Walter Cronkite was my role model. And he was actually a wonderful man. He was self-effacing, genuine, good reporter, good anchorman. He had credibility, and he was fair. He was, I just worshipped him, but I worked with a lot of anchormen who I believe, I say in the book, they suffered from a disease called big shotitis. They had delusions of grandeur. They used up all the oxygen in the room. They were unbearably self-absorbed, unrelenting hubris. And my favorite was they had delusions of sexual prowess. You know, what are you going to do?
Delusion, for sure. This person has read the book, it's clear to me, because she said, I'd like to know more about Newt Gingrich and his mommy.
Oh, that was a very awkward situation. I wanted to, when Newt Gingrich became Speaker of the House, it was a big moment. It was the so-called Republican Revolution, and he was bold and brassy. He was going to go up against President Bill Clinton and not be shy about it. He would not do an interview as he was embarking on this huge job, but he did offer an interview with his parents. I interviewed his mother and father, and the mother was a feisty woman as well. I could tell that how he got his confidence. I asked her, what does your son think of President Clinton? And she said, I can't tell you what he thinks of President Clinton, but I can tell you, and I can't tell you what he thinks of, and I can't tell you what he thinks of Hillary Clinton. And I said, yes, you can. You can tell me if the cameras are rolling. And she said, and she used the B word. And unfortunately for me, CBS put that small clip out in the press. And it was very much out of context because she had whispered it because she was playing a game with me. Prior to that, she's kind of like those older women who couldn't say he's dying of cancer or they're getting a divorce. So she was whispering it to me, and unfortunately it hit me hard when it went public, because Newt Gingrich understood the art of the spin, and he spinned it against me that I had snookered his elderly mother into saying something she didn't mean to say. So I was taken to the woodshed for it.
Indeed. When people saw the whole thing, did they still concentrate on that little clip, or?
No, many people who actually saw the whole story when it aired a day or two later came around and said, I didn't do anything wrong. It was not fun to be called a lot of names at the time.
They wouldn't do that to a man.
she's such a feminist. Kidding you?
So your sisters were all born in China. Your parents, your mom especially, didn't speak English much at all at the beginning.
She couldn't speak English, and she couldn't read and write English. My father could, because he went to an academy in China, mm-hmm. and learned how to speak English and write English.
How is your Chinese?
It's not bad, but it's not good. I can speak and understand, but I get scared to speak. And also, there are a lot of idiomatic expressions that are peculiar to my mother's hometown and my father's hometown. My parents are from cities just outside of Shanghai. My father's from Suzhou, and my mother's from Nanjing. And it's there are peculiar idiomatic expressions that only the people understand, and it's a version of Mandarin. So it's I get scared when I have to speak.
Well, this I asked that because this person asked the question. I remember that you were in the news when we opened China, our relationship with China, and it seemed you should have been in and out of China a lot, but it doesn't seem you were. Did I miss something, this person asked?
Pardon me?
Were you being sent to China to cover the opening of China and all the different things?
I was not sent, yeah. I was not sent. When Nixon opened the doors to China, I was angling to be sent, but I was new to CBS, and I didn't have enough experience, and they really, the bosses wanted, actually, so many people wanted to go to China. We had vice presidents who were volunteering to go, just and volunteering to just help out, carry bags, whatever, because they were itching to go on that trip.
It seems they should have picked someone who spoke Chinese to me.
Oh, yeah, but. Duh.
These two questions kind of go together. One person says, as you mentioned, there seems to be too much opinion and not much fact in journalism right now. Where do you get your news?
Where do I get my news?
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to ferret out the facts, don't you think? You know, because it's so opinionated. I try to read a full plate of sources in terms of, I actually like to read the actual newspaper instead of reading online. I'm so old fashioned. I like reading the standard ones, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and then the tabloids in New York. I live in New York. And I'm sorry. It's, you know, kind of fun to look through and see what kind of silly news they have. And then, but online, I read Politico and Axios and Punchbowl and, you know, let me think. I'm missing one. But on television, I have a really hard time because I think cable is so biased. It's mm-hmm. and they keep repeating the same stories, and but not everybody on cable is an opinionist. There are a lot of old reporters that I used to work with who are terrific. The networks have become antiquated, and they're kind of out of the mainstream. Digital is really where it is. So I've found that the pendulum has swung so wildly away from fact-based news. I don't know what's going to happen. I can tell you one thing. My husband started a newspaper in Montana, and because he's trying to create the old-fashioned news, and he has. It's a wonderful online paper. It started out as a print edition. And it has won every year awards for best newspaper, best online, best investigative reporting, and it's a joy to see. I think if we can change each city's local news, whether it's local TV news or local newspapers, city by city, we might be able to swing the pendulum back again to fact-based news. I hope so.
I hope so. Which brings me to what might be the last question, but this person says, you don't have to tell us how you're voting, we can figure that out, but do you have fears about the news in the election coming up and the fake news? And not fake news the way some people say it.
You know what? I realize what my problem is. I can't hear anymore.
Oh, so let me tell you.
My husband keeps saying, you have to get hearing aids.
With this election coming up, how are you worried about the whatever they call them, AI things and all that's likely to happen, and how do people find out what they're watching and whether it's real?
Yeah, I do. I don't understand AI, and I it frightens me a lot because I don't really get it. And I don't know how we can, I'm hoping that somebody will be able to tell us and that the government will do something that will save us from this creation that is fake. Mm-hmm. I really do believe it's a problem, but I don't understand it enough to be able to embrace it and have some kind of wisdom about it, sorry to say. Do you all understand AI? Really, you do? Kind of? Sorry?
It's scary, she said. It's scary.
It's scary, huh? Right? Yeah. Oh, wait, really? That's crazy.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think we
could get into that. Because
yeah, but we better not.
Somebody did want to know what you think of Fox News. I'm sure it's not your favorite station.
You really? I don't want to go there. No, I mean, I don't want to weigh in, you know, because I think there's a lot of partisanship on, you know, at all the networks. And we never did that. We never, ever expressed, we were never opinionated. That was verboten. And I think in many ways we bent over backwards. If we had an opinion, we wanted to be sure that we never expressed it. I mean, I guarantee you that a lot of people a lot of the reporters who were covering George McGovern in 1972 when I covered it, I think they were probably voting for McGovern, but they were tough on him because they were bending over backwards to be fair and mm-hmm. to be objective. But reporters we are but human beings, so it's really difficult for us to, report straight. But mm-hmm. we do. I mean, we did. But they don't do that anymore. The opinion is just spilling out there, which I think is dead wrong.
Yeah.
Do you? Yeah, no? You like the opinion? Thank you.
Okay. Someone said to me once, the opinion pages are for opinion.
I'm sorry,
but now it's all bleeding into the front page. Mm. And so I think there's something to that. One other quick question, and I know that everybody has to go home and do things other than be here, but you have seen the worst and the best of the news world.
Of what?
Of news reporting. And could you tell us who you most admire in the news world today?
In the news world today?
Mm-hmm.
I think in general I really admire investigative reporters because they, I used to really get gratification when I would do an investigative report, and if I could change a government policy that was wrong, or if I could correct a government ill, then, or a societal ill, I felt as if I were doing my job as a member of the Fourth Estate. I was pointing out what we were supposed to do. We're supposed to find out, as the Fourth Estate, information that someone is holding back. And if we can investigate it and find out what is going on, I think we've accomplished, we've contributed to, it's like your nonprofit. You know, these people are doing, the philanthropists that I met today are doing good work for the benefit of our society, for the benefit of our community. And that's always the way I felt as a reporter, that I was serving the public. I was asking questions that you wanted me to ask, or that you might have thought of that you wanted to find out about.
And as you read the book, you will find some of the most shocking things that Connie unearthed in her investigative reporting. It's one of the things about the book I love the most, because it gave me hope that good journalism could save us all. And so thank you for being a pioneer in that, and for the work you did with breast implants and killings and racial killings and Ku Klux Klan. You are all, don't plan to go to sleep tonight. You are going to have a good time reading this book. And Connie, you are a wonder, and we feel so lucky you came to Dominican for us.
Elaine, oh. You know what? Elaine is your rock star. She is, with Book Passages, she's quite amazing. I mean, in this little time, I have gotten to know Elaine, and she, her face, she smiles with her face and her eyes, you know? And I love that about her, and she's tough, I can tell. Yeah. And she does take no prisoners, really. I'm just delighted to have met you. And she really did read my book, and she was recounting things. And that just makes me so grateful what took me forever to write was worth it. Yeah. Because Elaine likes it.
Thank you, our hero, Connie Chung, and thanks to all of you for being here with us. And go forth and read the book and tell everyone about it, because it is an incredible piece of history as well, because Connie was there whenever... She was in the room when it happened. She was there covering it, and she's still at it. So we are very fortunate. Thank you very much, Connie.
Oh. Elaine, I forgot to tell you that I just discovered that my book is on the New York Times bestsellers list. Woo! Are any of you on Instagram? Okay, my husband suggested that I get on Instagram, and my name is Connie Chung Povich, P-O-V-I-C-H. So please get on Instagram, because I've never been on social media, and it's been quite an experience.
Well, you were in the company of social media experts, because
really?
we have young people in the audience tonight.
Oh, great.
And they are going to make you very happy when your husband tells you what they posted.
Thank you.
Thank you.